This is Audible.
Hello Sunshine, in partnership with Audible, presents The Baddest Bitch in the Room, written and narrated by Sophia Chang.
Prologue. One Saturday afternoon in the summer of 93, Prince Rakim, now known as the RZA, founder of the Wu-Tang Clan, invited me to the studio. Truth is, I probably invited myself. I had recently met the collective after hearing their 3-song demo that had the whole music industry buzzing. 9 guys from Staten Island, whose aesthetic was grounded in the kung fu movies they'd watched every Saturday afternoon on Channel 5 and skipped school to see at Times Square. RZA's beats were as dirty as the sticky floors of those theaters. And then their rhymes. The guys sounded like they would leap through the speakers and grab you by the throat if you didn't heed their dire warning to protect your neck. It had been 5 years since I'd fled Vancouver for New York to pursue a career in music. I was 28, single, no kids, and life was pretty damn good. I had befriended a number of amazing artists and landed a coveted position as an A&R person, a talent scout, at Jive Records, one of the preeminent hip-hop labels whose roster would shape the genre for decades to come. Yet, despite considerable accomplishments and life in the rap lane, as the first Asian woman in hip-hop, I was still plagued by doubts of where and if I belonged. I had not followed the path, doctor, lawyer, scholar, that my Korean immigrant parents had envisioned for me. Luckily, there was a trail of beats and basslines to pursue. I couldn't sign Wu-Tang because of the parameters of the deal they demanded, but I was a fervent fan nonetheless and determined to spend as much time with them as possible. I felt beckoned into their formidable chamber. I jumped down the stairs of my second-story walk-up 2 at a time in a white t-shirt and gray terry shorts that I'd nabbed at a DKNY sample sale. I raced up 7th Avenue to Battery Studios, which was located in the same building as Jive. There was a heat wave throttling New York City, already choking with tension and humidity. When I got to the studio, I was sweaty and relieved to feel the blast of air conditioning. As I entered the control room, Method Man jumped up and dragged me by the hand into the back lounge, barely letting me greet the rest of the guys.
Sophie, I just got my video and you gotta see it.
At this point, the world had only seen one music video from Wu-Tang for Protect Your Neck. That song had catapulted the Staten Island Collective into the hearts and minds of the hip-hop cognoscenti, and everyone knew that their rise would be meteoric. Everyone also knew, after hearing just 14 bars, that Method Man would be the group's biggest star. And I was about to get a personal sneak preview of the video for his solo song, one of only 2 on the album, Method Man. He led me to a black leather love seat and gently patted the worn cushion with his big, strong hand. The scars on his knuckles marked the countless times he must have used his fist to defend himself, his turf, his loved ones. I sat back as he slid the VHS tape into the machine and waited for it to click into the spools before pushing play. I slid over, expecting him to sit next to me, but he shook his head.
Nah, Sophie, you sit. I'm good.
He receded into the wall like a long, lean phantom at an angle that allowed him to study my reaction. Sitting directly across from me, next to the TV, was Jamal, one of the clan's crew, also intent on watching me. Chilled by his cold energy, I could see that he was trying to figure out how this little Asian woman, clearly not a groupie, had made her way into the inner sanctum. But I was there for Meth, and ignored Jamal's glare. As the video played, my face broke into a huge smile, hands clasped in sheer elation. Like its predecessor, it was low-budget, grainy, and poorly edited, but the intensity and personality of the clan were undeniable. In the video, they brandished hoodies, Tims, kung fu swords, and, of course, weed. And the song's star shone like Sirius A. Meth's raging charisma, spring-loaded agility, and scruffy good looks surged through the screen. As the video finished, I started to gush, but then Jamal interrupted me. Where are you from? Excuse me? I said, where are you from? I don't understand what you're asking me. That was a lie. I've been asked this countless times before. I chose to play naive because I was caught off guard and didn't want to be adversarial in someone else's house. Where are you from is a loaded question for people of color. Like its evil stepsister, who are you? It's a question that's not asking, but saying something like, who do you think you are to be in my world because you clearly don't belong? Where are you from? Well, if you're asking my heritage, I'm Korean Canadian. If you're asking where I live in Manhattan. If you want to know where I work, but before I could finish, Meth flew between us, yelling at the top of his lungs.
That's Sophie Chang, and she from Shaolin, nigga. She down with Wu-Tang. That's all you need to know, all right? Who the fuck is you to ask her where she from anyway? Don't you ever fucking disrespect her again.
I sat bolt upright, eyes wide, mouth agape. This total sweetheart, who had a kind word for everyone, transformed before my eyes into a fury-breathing dragon. As his words shot through the air like poison darts, I saw he was rocking a cape emblazoned with a giant M rippling in the wind of his fury. He sucked all the oxygen out of the room and took up every cubic inch of space. In that moment, I swore my undying allegiance to Method Man. Not only did he defend me, an Asian woman whom he barely knew, against one of his own, but he also instantly understood the racial subtext of the query. His defense of me was at once potent and poetic. From that day on, each time I saw Meth, I knew he was watching over me. Until then, it had been up to me to defend myself. And now, here I was, with my own personal whooper hero. This was the first, but far from the last time, he would bring the ruckus on my behalf. I had started down the path that led me to Wu-Tang a decade prior in my final year of high school. Ray, a handsome Greek classmate known for being a music aficionado, brought a 12-inch record to school, excited to share his latest discovery with a group of us assembled in the music room during lunch hour. He lovingly tilted his two-dimensional prize at a slight angle and slowly slid the paper sleeve vinyl from its crisp cardboard cover. I didn't recognize the label at the center of the disc. It was light blue and appeared to feature a colored snake. He set the turntable to 33 RPM and placed the needle under the edge of the shiny black disc. As the familiar scratch crackled through the speakers, I studied the cover, which featured seven black men rocking studded leather belts, wristbands, and gloves, along with Kangol hats and tight designer jeans. I'd never seen anything like it. I cocked my head as the first synth notes of The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five sailed through the room. My whole body moved, almost involuntarily, when the beat dropped. I had been a dancing fool since the age of three, from shimmying on the couch, to making up routines in my bedroom, to learning to do the hustle. The bottom of the song hit me in the solar plexus, and the lyrics set my imagination on fire.
Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley.
It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder. The urban landscape the MCs painted was so far from my quaint suburbia, but something in the music spoke to me. Listening to that song was like taking the red pill in the Matrix. Once I'd heard it, I could never unhear it, and all music thereafter would be held to that standard of excellence and urgency and poetry and storytelling. In other words, I became a hip-hop devotee in precisely 7 minutes and 10 seconds. Soon thereafter, I would move to the birthplace of hip-hop. This French major ditched Balzac, Flaubert, and Proust for LL Cool J, Run-DMC, and Public Enemy. Shortly after arriving in New York, I snagged my first gig working with Paul Simon, and I knew that I had found my calling, to help artists realize their creative vision. Over the next 30 years, I would spend the vast majority of my energy helping remarkably talented men like Old Dirty Bastard, rest in peace, the RZA, the GZA, Raphael Sadiq, and D'Angelo tell their stories. I enjoyed it and excelled at it. It wasn't until I was 50, that I understood it was time to tell mine, and that by sharing my story, I could help other people. That, after all, is what we're here for, to be in service of others. But why did it take so long? I had internalized the myriad messages over my lifetime from society that my role as an Asian woman was to be efficient and diligent and always in a supporting role behind the scenes. Despite attending global high wattage events, I skirted the red carpet and shunned the spotlight. Don't look at the woman behind the curtain. It was a circuitous route that brought me to these words, to this mission, to myself. As a child, I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to be a fashion designer. I wanted to be rich enough to buy myself a big, shiny emerald, my birthstone. But above all, I wanted to be white. Every week I devoured the Brady Bunch and Vogue magazine, blissfully unaware that I didn't see myself on the TV screen or in the glossy pages. Like many first-gen immigrants, I had lost the language and rejected the culture. Hanging out with artists like A Tribe Called Quest, Jungle Brothers, and De La Soul, who led the Native Tongues movement steeped in Afrocentrism, opened my eyes to another possibility. Watching these artists yearn for a connection to their motherland kindled in me a curiosity about mine. That low-burning flame burst into an inferno when I met Wu-Tang. Experiencing up close the clan's deep love of and respect for Asian culture was phenomenally empowering. They introduced me to kung fu flicks and a new lens through which to view modern Asian masculinity. Having been raised in the West, it was revelatory to enter this world of cinema where my brothers were the hero, the villain, and the lover, as opposed to the emasculated roles to which Hollywood had relegated them. And they were fucking hot. Not long after, this influence led me to train in kung fu with a Shaolin monk who would become my partner and the father of my children. At 30, I took a hard right out of the music business to immerse my body, soul, and spirit into the world of martial arts and Buddhism. Together, we transformed my physique into an exquisitely maintained temple, integrating the Chan teachings of Bodhidharma into my quotidian life and establishing a lifelong practice that I still keep today, nearly 3 decades later. What I love about hip-hop and Wu-Tang in particular was that they made it acceptable not only to be angry, but also to express that rage through art. Despite my good grades and deference to the Confucian ideal, I was never the model minority. As a petite Asian woman, I never had the luxury to simply lean in. I had to kick down the motherfucking door. I had to learn to be big and strong in other ways. As the RZA would say, my tongue is my sword, and I assure you, I have eviscerated many in my day. Listen, I am not the apathetic automaton in accounting chained to her desk in a windowless office, dutifully making sure the bills get paid on time. I am the fearless CEO prowling the streets of the concrete jungle, whose hustle and ingenuity bring in the cream that pays your salary and puts food on your table. I am not the submissive geisha in a pastel silk kimono who shuffles in, head bowed, to serve you your tea. Look again. I am the ninja samurai in a Gucci leather fedora who swoops in unannounced and decapitates you in a single effortless stroke, without an iota of compunction, to serve you your head. And finally, I am not some exotic, erotic, ethnic trophy that you dangle on your arm like a diamond-studded Patek. Nah, B. I am the fearsome empress sitting on the throne, to whom you bend the knee, and whose bling you kiss. In short, fuck your model minority. My name is Sophia Chang, and this is the story of how I became the baddest bitch in the room. Chapter 1. Where are you from? My family never said I love you like the white families. Did I doubt my parents loved me? Didn't even think about it. We were family. The love my parents had for my brother and me far preceded our births, before they even met. It accrued with every step they took from childhood that eventually led them to a foreign land. In that single act, they had left behind everything they knew, their families, their language, their culture, all in pursuit of a better life for themselves, but more importantly, for their children to come. Hesok, number one son, golden boy, top of every class, good at every fucking thing. And me, a bullheaded Taurus, fair to middling student. According to my family, I was independent from the gate. My earliest memories are from 1968, when my father taught at the University of Michigan for a year. Somehow, I got it into my head that I wanted to go for a spin around the campus and took it upon myself to do so. I was 3. There are so many things wrong with this picture. How did I get out of the house, into the streets, to the bus stop? How did the bus driver allow an unattended toddler to board the bus without any questions asked? What were the other passengers thinking? The parent in me now would shame the shit out of those parents. But I've got Nathan. It was 1968, and things were much different back then. Perhaps not so much that a toddler could ride semi-private transportation alone with ease, but certainly, parenting in the late 60s did not involve the constant hovering that it does now. All things considered, my parents did a remarkable job. My mother, Tongsuk Park, was born in 1932 on May 17th in Kiang, North Korea, the 4th of 9 children. Her father was a department store owner, and her mother a housewife with a keen business mind. Apparently, I am just like her. My mother is no impresario, but she is an unbroken warrior. After the Japanese surrendered at the end of the Second World War in August 1945, the Korean Peninsula was divided into North and South at the 38th parallel, with Russia occupying the former, the U.S. the latter. My mother said they'd heard reports that the Russians were raping the women and pillaging the towns as soon as they landed. Luckily, they started in the big cities and hadn't reached her small town before my grandfather, Seonggyu, arranged for my mother, then 14, and her 16-year-old sister, Tongnam, to follow their 2 older brothers to the south. He paid a hotelier who had been sneaking people out of the north on boats. They dressed down like locals so as not to stand out. They boarded a train, and when they arrived at their station, they were elated to be one step closer to freedom and reunited with their older brothers. Their joy would be short-lived. They had gotten off a stop too early.
There were 2 heads, south heads and north heads. Yeah. We supposed to go to north heads, but we didn't know there were 2 heads.
The police were at the station on the lookout for people trying to escape the north. Despite their disguises, my mother and her sister were detected immediately and taken to the police station, where they were separated and questioned. Not having anticipated this, they gave conflicting stories. Seeing as the next train back to their hometown was in the morning, they would spend the night at a police-sanctioned hotel and be escorted back to the station. Serendipitously, a man standing nearby at the police station, not an officer, but someone with great authority, overheard the entire exchange. I don't think he was a man, rather a bodhisattva. This is a being in Buddhism who has reached nirvana but chooses to stay on earth to alleviate the suffering of others. He took pity on my mother and aunt and offered to take them on a tour of the town before delivering them to the hotel the police had checked them into for the night. Miraculously, as they were walking about, the sister spotted another hotel, branded with the name of the hotelier whom they were supposed to meet to take them across the border. They made a mental note, desperate to get back to it somehow. My aunt fell very ill overnight, and when the police came to pick the girls up the next morning, they decided to let her rest another day. The sister saw their opening. The other hotel wasn't far, but the town was small, and they were terrified of being spotted and apprehended again. Happily, they made it there without incident, and the man they were supposed to meet was there. He arranged for someone to sneak them out in the dead of night. At around 1 a.m., another man picked them up at the hotel, He didn't have any lights. No lamp, no flashlight, nothing. And there were no street lights. My mother and aunt stumbled in the pitch black night until they got to the beach, where they were handed off to a third man with a boat. Even the beach was utter darkness. They saw nothing, heard nothing. The sisters were silently herded onto a small boat with about 30 other people. It was probably built to hold a third of that number. No one said a word as they held their breath in fear. The ride only lasted about 30 minutes, but felt interminable. The fear of capture was exacerbated by the rough water. The boat took on so much water that my mother and aunt were sure they were going to die. To this day, my mother has a morbid fear of rough water and airplane turbulence. When they finally reached the shores of South Korea, there were makeshift huts on the beach directly in front of them. Everyone crowded into the huts and sat on the cold ground awaiting daybreak. The next morning, huge U.S. Army trucks arrived to transport the refugees to Seoul. Once in Seoul, the sisters took a bus to meet their older brothers, Tong Chun and Tong Suk, who had rented space in a small two-family house. My aunt cried nonstop for days and weeks and months, but my mother didn't shed one tear. Perhaps watching her sister prompted her to stay strong for both of them. My mother recounted this story to me when I was around 10, in much less detail and in a matter-of-fact manner, as if she were reciting a recipe. I was sitting on the corner of my parents' bed, not quite facing her. As she continued with her account, I felt my body shrinking in anguish, and I bowed my head to look at the pink polyester quilted bedding, fidgeting with a non-existent loose thread. I watched as the tears, slowly at first, dropped onto the quilt, darkening it with each drop. By the time she was done, I turned to her, tears streaming down my face. She was surprised. She didn't comfort me, and I didn't expect her to. I asked if she could contact her family. She hadn't seen or spoken to her parents or her five younger siblings since she'd sneaked out that night. She explained that the government made it very difficult for them to have any contact. 5 short years after the end of the Second World War, the Korean War broke out between the North and the South, each declaring itself the single legitimate government of Korea. During the Korean War, Tong Sup joined a makeshift army that fought with the Americans who were advancing against the North. There, he reconnected with the family. Then the Chinese army intervened on behalf of North Korea and pushed the South Korean army back. There were a number of U.S. ships taking people from the North to the South. By the time my uncle had gathered the family, the last ship was loading. Because they had to get there by foot, my grandmother determined that they wouldn't make it because of the children, so she sent my uncle ahead without them. When he got back to the South, he was so distraught that he was unable to speak about what had happened for a long time. Later, they heard my grandfather was killed during the Korean War, but they had no way of verifying it. My mother thinks that if any of her brothers and sisters survived, they are currently in labor camps. When my mother and aunt left that day in 1946, they never imagined that it would be the last time they would see their parents and younger siblings. They expected that their remaining family would follow and be reunited in the South. I couldn't fathom never seeing my parents and brother again. More painful still to imagine is the thought of never seeing my children again and them not seeing each other. My son and daughter are now both older than my mother was when she escaped North Korea. It means that every moment I've enjoyed, endured, and engineered with my children over the past few years would never have happened, not even vapors that I could imagine, if I had been in the position of my grandparents who had to send their children away in order to save them. As a parent, even the shitty moments are moments, opportunities to learn from, work through, and all the while, love your children. My mother finished high school in Incheon, strong in English and German. Like her, my strength was languages, and we both hated math. From there, she attended Seoul Daek, or Seoul National University, where she met my father, Bomchik Chang, who was born in Incheon, South Korea, a year before her. His father was the head of the Korean Rice Granary Company. My dad was a smart, highly competitive boy with a healthy ego, all traits he would pass on to me. He liked to make things with his hands, draw, and play harmonica, but mathematics was his true gift and passion. As a teen, the first word he wrote in his notebook with the new pen he had bought was mathematics. Well known in Incheon for his intelligence, my father earned the nickname the Razor. He was named not only for his incredible intellectual capacity, but also for his appearance. He had beautiful high cheekbones and was as sharp a dresser as there ever was. He and my mother made an exceptionally good-looking couple. The Japanese had annexed Korea in 1910 and continued their occupation until the end of World War II. Koreans were marginalized and forced to learn Japanese. If they were caught speaking Korean in school, they were beaten. The Japanese created schools that were exclusively intended to educate Japanese children because they didn't want their kids mixing with the Koreans. Because my father was so smart, he was one of only a few Koreans permitted to attend one of the exclusively Japanese schools. He even skipped a grade and started a year early. His mathematics teacher initially favored him because of his talent, but erupted in anger when he discovered he was Korean. My father spoke impeccable Japanese. The teacher would put a problem on the chalkboard and ask if anyone could solve it. Often, no one but my father knew how to do it. He approached the board and solved the problem correctly. When he was done, the teacher would beat him with a ruler. This would happen a couple more times before my father stopped volunteering. But the teacher found another way to humiliate my father. All the Japanese students would come to school with their lunches packed in bento boxes. My father was too poor to bring one. The teacher said that someone had been stealing lunch boxes and wanted to discover who the culprit was. He asked everyone to place their boxes on the table, and when my father was the only student without one, the teacher announced that he must be the bento box thief. He proceeded to beat my father yet again. Decades later, my mother and father went to Japan for a school reunion. My father told my mother that if he saw that teacher again, he would punch him in the face. Unfortunately, he didn't have the opportunity. When the Japanese occupation ended after the war, my father was in 10th grade. The principal of my father's school told him to sit in the front of the class every time a new math teacher was hired. He was to ask the teacher questions in order to vet him. He was recognized as a genius. My father was 18 when the Korean War broke out and the North Korean army marched into Incheon. One day, he was summoned to a meeting at the local ward office, at which all the unsuspecting attendees were forced to join the South Korean volunteer army on the spot. None of them even returned home from the meeting. They were made to travel by foot to an unknown destination in North Korea. At some point north of Seoul, my father began to slow down, moving farther and farther away from his group, and eventually turning back without being noticed. By dint of sheer will and a little luck, he escaped and made it back home. He did his first 2 years of graduate studies at Seoul National University and finished his studies at the University of British Columbia in 1956, after being invited there by one of his colleagues. He returned to Korea to teach mathematics at his alma mater. My parents married on November 15, 1960, and my brother Hee-seok was born March 13, 1962. A few months after he was born, my father came to Vancouver to teach at the University of British Columbia. He told my mother that he cried every time he saw babies because he missed his son so much. My mother followed in the fall of 1963, leaving Hee-seok behind. My father's mother was worried that if the whole family left, they would never return to Korea, so she promised to raise Hee-seok while they were gone. This is a common practice for migrants that allows the parents to establish themselves financially and settle in before having the children come over. She brought Hee-seok to Vancouver in early 1964. I was the first in my family to be born outside of Korea and the only one to be named in English. My father named me after a Polish mathematician. Sophie is the Latin word for wisdom. In addition to riding the bus, I have a couple of other clear memories of my father's tenure teaching in Ann Arbor. I distinctly remember learning to read. Once again, folks, do the math. In 1968, I was 3. Genius! My father had written a bunch of words on index cards and was teaching Hesok to read. Already extremely competitive with my brother, I was fiending to catch up. The first word I read was butterfly. Until this moment, I had been fastidiously but silently studying as well. When my father held up the card, I blurted out, "Butterfly!" before Hesok could. The intellectual sibling rivalry between me and my brother was, in fact, no contest whatsoever. Hesok is exponentially smarter than me and everyone else I know combined. It was intimidating to walk in the oversized footsteps of my brother, a challenge for someone as competitive as I am. We went to a small elementary school, an even smaller high school, and we took many of the same classes in college. Every first day of class throughout my underwhelming academic career, when I raised my hand for roll call, the teacher would lower their glasses, raise their eyebrows at me, and say, "Oh, so you're Hesok's sister." Hesok also teased me to no end. He knew exactly how to push my buttons and did so often. I remember screaming and chasing him around my uncle's house with a boot while my mother and aunt sat calmly, talking and drinking tea as if nothing was going on. I'm pretty sure there was another incident involving a steak knife and laps around our house. One summer day, we were examining ourselves in the mirror, and I said proudly, "I'm more tan than you." And I was.
"Yeah, but you're ship brown, and I'm golden brown."
Hesok's excellence was not limited to academia. He was also a phenomenal athlete. That motherfucker could play any sport. He taught me to spiral a pigskin, shoot a 3, slap a puck, and throw a curve. But I was never very physically gifted. This shortcoming was impossible to hide and very humiliating. Back in the day, the phys ed teachers would elect 2 captains, always the jocks, who would stand at the front of the classroom to choose their teammates, excruciatingly peeling off one person at a time, from best to worst. I was almost always last to be chosen. Then there were physical endurance challenges that we had to do with the whole class watching, the flexed arm hang, or running laps, or climbing a rope. I couldn't do any of it. I had neither stamina nor strength. But I could dance my bony ass off. The first time I recall dancing was in Michigan at 3. I was on the couch boogieing with abandon, and my father exclaimed, "Where did you learn to dance?" I don't even know what music was playing, but I recall how moving my body in rhythm with the beat felt so free. When disco hit, I was completely engrossed. I watched American Bandstand every Saturday and went to see Saturday Night Fever and Thank God It's Friday multiple times. I taught myself the hustle, the bump, and how to spell out YMCA with my body, and I created routines in my bedroom. I helped plan dances at friends' houses as well as the ones at school. I was a natural-born leader and extremely social. I worked hard to be the most popular, smartest, best-dressed, and teacher's pet, and I could be a cruel ruler. There was one particular girl who had been my best friend before we had a falling out, after which I ostracized her. One day, my teacher asked me to stay after school. As her favorite, I was sure she was going to laud me for my scholastic achievements. Once the classroom had cleared out, I sat down across from her and waited smugly to hear how amazing I was. "You know, Sophia, there are a group of parents who have come together against..." For some reason, I was convinced that the next word out of her mouth was going to be Asians. But instead, she said, "People who don't let others be friends with certain students. Do you know what I'm talking about?" I feigned innocence, but she knew that I knew that she knew. The next day, the desks were moved, and I was forced to sit next to the girl I had shunned. It was just the two of us, whereas the other desks were clustered into groups of 4 or 6.
and it worked. We ended up becoming friends again. When I look back on that incident, it's amazing that despite being the queen of my school, I thought she was going to tell me that a group of parents was conspiring against Asian students. I still felt other. And surely my overachieving ambitions were in response to feeling marginalized. Having been called racist names, I understood on some level that a lot of the prejudices propagated by the children were passed down to them by their parents. There was racism lurking in the tidy stucco homes behind the white picket fences. One sunny spring day, as I walked alone across Balaclava Park, one of Vancouver's countless massive green spaces, I was suddenly struck by how empty it was. Typically, there would be people playing rugby in the giant field or running track, and kids lolling about in the sandbox. The sprawling Emerald Meadow meant fun and freedom under open skies, but it was about to become a battleground. I sensed a presence behind me. "Where are you from?" Reuben, the class bully, a big, lurching white boy with dirty blonde hair and rage in his eyes, circled me slowly on his blue Schwinn chopper. He stopped right in front of me, cutting me off in my tracks. I looked at him and didn't answer. I was caught off guard by his overt hostility. I said, "Where are you from? China or Japan?" To engage or not to engage? I was only 9 and had already felt the demeaning sting of thoughtless, racist barbs for years. Sometimes, if I was lucky, I would be serenaded with this charming little ditty. "Chinese, Japanese, dirty knees, look at these." The kids would sing, using their fingers to slant their eyes up, indicating Chinese, then down, indicating Japanese, putting their hands on their knees, and then, for the roaring finale, pulling their shirts out to mimic a big chest. Who the fuck wrote that song? In addition to being made acutely aware of my difference in ethnicity, I was also constantly reminded of my size. I was short to medium height, but really skinny. The older boys in school used to literally toss me from one to the other like a ball. It was all in fun, but in retrospect, it was still a clear assertion of physical dominance. People would also hold my arm up in midair and say loudly, "Look how skinny she is! Look how small her wrists are!" In the past, I had kept quiet or responded feebly, but not today, Satan. Not today. Only days before, I had stood silent and helpless as a greasy white teen passed by our house yelling, "Hey, chink, go back to your country," at my dad's back as he tended to the peonies in our garden. I had watched as my father ignored the bait and clenched the wooden handle of the spade in his gloved hand. My mercury rose in a tide of rage, while my heart sank in a pit of humiliation and heartache. All the chinks, Japs, and gooks carelessly hurtled my way were an indignity. But watching my father be the recipient of such bile irreversibly activated something in me. I had inherited my father's short temper and, like him, had to learn to choose my battles. The difference between him and me was that I had the most lethal weapon at my disposal, the English language. And this brilliant, sunny afternoon in the park was the day that I would unlock the safety. Truth is, in a battle of wits, me against Reuben was like bringing an AK to a plastic knife fight. But I held back on unleashing an automatic, choosing only to fire a couple of choice shots instead. "I'm from Korea," I rallied back. "What?" "Korea. Your geography is pretty bad if the only countries you know in Asia are China and Japan. Maybe you should study harder in school, Reuben." I could taste the rage in my saliva. He grunted in response. When he realized that he hadn't succeeded in terrorizing me, he got back on his bike and trundled away. I saw Reuben again in school, but there were no more confrontations. Walking home, I was high on victory. I felt indomitable. From this day forward, I felt prepared for any verbal jousting match. Look, this isn't a woe-is-me story. Rather, a yo, it's me saga. My life wasn't a horror show of constant racist attacks and threats, but growing up the child of Asian immigrants in a white world made it a challenge to establish my identity. My birth certificate says I'm a citizen of Canada, but I didn't feel fully Canadian because I wasn't white. Nor was I totally Korean because I had lost the language, a common experience among first-generation immigrants. Not only did I reject the language, but also the culture and cuisine. When I was around 10, my mother had to make me cheeseburgers for a few months, while the rest of the family ate robustly textured and complexly flavored Korean meals. My mother thought I was a picky eater, so she did what she thought any mother should, feed her child, even if it meant preparing a separate meal. But it wasn't my palate. It was my pride. I was embarrassed by and ashamed of our food, which kids made fun of because it looked and smelled differently. Part of my rejection of Korean culture was witnessing it be rejected by our adopted country. Despite my desperate measures to assimilate, my world continued to remind me in no uncertain terms that I was other, lesser, and an outsider. Assimilation meant, quite simply, trying to be white. Everyone I saw as I pored through the pages of fashion magazines, flipped through the TV channels, or sat in movie theaters was white. The only time I saw characters who looked like me were the extras in MASH, Hawaii Five-O, and Kung Fu. It didn't even cross my mind that David Carradine was a white man playing an Asian character. One of my favorite shows in the 70s was The Partridge Family, about a widowed mother who forms a band with her 5 children. Like millions of other girls across North America, I was infatuated with the eldest son, Keith, played by David Cassidy, with his soft brown eyes, perfectly feathered hair, and signature puka shells that glowed beneath his large collared polyester shirts. If David Cassidy was my first puppy love, then Susan Day, who played his sister Lori, was my first girl crush. She had big green eyes, long thick eyelashes, and flawlessly curled hair. Little did I know that this bubblegum reverie would come back to slap me in the face. One afternoon, alone in my room, I was pretending to be Lori Partridge, singing and playing keyboards on my bed. I lost myself in the performance. When I reached the chorus of "I Think I Love You," I turned and looked in the mirror and was shocked when I saw an Asian face looking back at me. I had convinced myself that I was white. As someone who has complained about being invisible her whole life, I now recognize that in that moment, I had erased myself. The other show I watched without fail was The Brady Bunch. I thought they were the perfect family, never mind that they were the result of 2 divorced parents coming together, each with their 3 children from previous spouses. All I saw was Hollywood happiness in the home, a beautiful blonde mother with 3 blonde daughters. My family looked different and talked different. One night after dinner, I got up and said, "Thanks, Mom. That was a delicious dinner." Hesok sneered at me.
"Did you just see that in The Brady Bunch?"
It stung because he was dead on. I felt like such a fraud. The Asians we went to school with were predominantly Chinese. They embodied the model minority, hardworking, bespectacled, great at science and math, squeaky clean, and kept their heads down. No shade. That's who they were. It just wasn't me. There was also a group of Vietnamese kids who were in the English as a second language program at our high school. I used to look at them as other because we didn't speak the same language. By high school, I became aware that there was a difference not only in physical appearance, but also in class. Our high school sat at the bottom of the valley. We lived on the middle class side, while many of the other students lived on the wealthy side. These kids alternated between their Whistler homes in Hawaii for Christmas vacations. They would come back rocking tans and baseball shirts with Maui 82 printed on them. The rich kids were also often the most popular kids. They were white girls and boys with shiny straight teeth and feathered hair who cruised the streets of Vancouver in their parents' Beamers, Benzes, and Porsches. Though different, my brother and I were still very popular. My brother because he was so fucking smart and funny, but also because he was such a good athlete. I followed him in his other hobbies as well. I knew the name of every car, collected comic books, and could name most of the fighter planes from the Second World War. Hesok and I attended the mini school, a small annex of Prince of Wales High School for self-motivated and bright kids. In other words, brains, fucking geniuses. It was filled with brainiacs and misfits. One of the great things about our school, in addition to the rigorous academic program, was the diverse range of extracurricular activities. We did a lot of fundraising for our 3 annual field trips. We got to travel to places where we could ski, rock climb, hike, and sleep under the stars. Our school dances were filled with classic rock sprinkled with new wave. The perennial last song of every dance was Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. For all the boys and girls who had been crushing on each other, this was their chance to grope and grind for 8 glorious, unchaperoned minutes. Even though I was elected social coordinator 2 years in a row and painstakingly designed and printed the invitations on a mimeograph machine, I was never the girl that got asked to slow dance. I dreaded this part of the evening and always made sure I wasn't near the auditorium so I could avoid the humiliation of standing against the wall as the song started to play. To this day, I bristle when I hear the opening acoustic guitar strains of the song. It takes me right back to those days of rejection. In grade school, I grew up on top 40 pop and classic rock, but it was disco that I loved the most because it was dance music. In high school, we started listening to new wave and punk, The Jam, Joe Jackson, and my favorite band of all time, The Clash. Rest in peace, Joe Strummer. When Sandinista, the group's homage to the Nicaraguan political party, came out, I rocked a red beret and went to the Vancouver Public Library downtown to study the history of the movement. This album inspired my first interest in politics. But there was something beyond the anti-establishmentarian and leftist leanings of the punk movement that drew me to the music. There was also the anger that swelled in those imperfect vocals and screeching guitar. Punk was my gateway to hip-hop. My first boyfriend was a rakish Irish guitar player named Aaron. The moment I set eyes on him playing bass in a dive bar in Gastown, I knew he would be my boyfriend. We shared a love of music, mostly British punk and new wave, but diverged enormously when it came to hip-hop. One night in 1985, we were in the basement of my parents' house watching Much Music, Canada's version of MTV, when the video for Run DMC's King of Rock came on. I was glued to the TV and could barely contain my enthusiasm. His face was curled in disgust and disdain. "You like this? How could you possibly like this? It's not even music." That sentiment would be echoed by many all over the world for years to come. To me, hip-hop was a perfect parfait. It combined all the elements of the music that had informed my life. The compelling drama and narrative of opera, the infectious melodies and hooks of pop, the powerful vocal performances of crooners, the four-on-the-floor beats and danceability of disco, the rebellious messages and stripped-down arrangements of punk. And that's just what I could hear. Listening to the message on repeat was ear-opening, but seeing Run DMC's King of Rock video just that one time was eye-popping. They were so physically assertive, stomping their feet, slapping their chests, and the ultimate b-boy stance. Arms crossed high, hands tucked into the armpits, feet apart. This kind of unapologetic bearing was completely novel to me, an Asian woman who had been trained to shrink herself to accommodate others. Like most teenagers, I rebelled against my parents. Once I started driving at 16, it was hard to keep tabs on me. I didn't get drunk or high, mainly because I hated the thought of not being in control, but I started sneaking out to clubs in 12th grade. I went to the Pit, the university pub, to dance every week. It was filled with frat boys in letterman jackets drinking cheap beers by the pitcher. I would go to the center of the empty dance floor and let loose to whatever was playing. But my jam was Michael Jackson's Wannabe Starting Something. When Jackson's voice proclaimed, "Yeehaw!" I would jump up on one foot and kick the other in the air. Then there was the love affair, where the new waivers with gelled hair and asymmetrical shirts would dance to the likes of Depeche Mode, The Human League, and Culture Club. My signature song there, however, was not an 80s hit. It was Aretha Franklin's Respect. I would get on top of the speakers and get down to the Queen of Soul. I also went to see countless live shows. I figured out how to get backstage and became a straight-up groupie, except I didn't want to sleep with the artists. Well, not all of them. I mostly just wanted to meet them. I loved talking to the people and the minds behind the music. My going out was a source of tremendous tension between my father and me. Hesok told me that he had said to him, "We don't know what to do about Sophia. We never had these problems with you." My father didn't know how to handle it when I asked if I could go shopping with a 22-year-old guitar player. Why did I even ask? My father didn't really have a choice and was right to be concerned. I lost my virginity to that musician on a dirty mattress on the floor. In my life, I can only recall seeing my mother cry twice. Neither was at my father's death nor his funeral. The first was when I was taking a bath around 8 years old and started scooping water out of the tub with both hands because she'd done something to annoy me. I watched as she got on her hands and knees with the omnipresent kolle, Korean rag for cleaning every surface, and mopped up the water. The second was when I came home at around 18 and found her in the basement by herself crying. I asked her what was wrong, and she opened her hands to show me that she had discovered my birth control pills.
"I just want you to have good life."
She couldn't stand having no idea who my partner was. She must have been concerned for my safety overall as well. Seeing her cry was devastating. But I didn't stop having sex, and I only grew more enamored with the music scene and musicians. Naturally, my focus on school waned. My parents didn't demand straight A's. They didn't yell at us if we fell short of perfect grades. Rather, they would kill us with silent looks of disappointment. I was a good student, but I was terrible at math. And when my father tried to teach me, it was dreadful for both of us. For me, because calculus is Latin for torture, and I was clearly disappointing my father. And for him, because I was so terrible at the thing that was his lifelong passion, and he couldn't get through to me. At some level, my brother and I understood the sacrifices our parents had made for us, particularly my mother, who took up sewing clothes for other people to make extra money. When I was 9, she went to work full-time at the UBC library, where she wrote out the catalog cards in Korean, Japanese, Chinese, and English by hand, which involved romanizing the Asian languages. Because of the occupation, she was fluent in Japanese, and luckily, she had studied Chinese at night because she and my father had wanted to visit China. As I made my way through college, skipping classes, neglecting reading assignments, and going out at every opportunity, it started to become clear to me that I had to get out of Vancouver. Neither the city nor my parents could contain me. I didn't have specific dreams. I just knew I wanted to leave. Like many of us raised in the suburbs or small towns, I longed to spread my wings in a major metropolis. Chapter 2. New York State of Grind. During Christmas break in 1985, my junior year of university, I leapt at the opportunity to visit my brother's friend Steve Palmer in New York. He was doing his graduate studies at Columbia. I stayed with him and his roommates in a four-bedroom apartment close to campus. I loved the Upper West Side with its brightly lit diners and cafes filled with students bristling with ideas. But it was the East Village, at the opposite end of the island, teeming with punks in leather and coal-laced eyes that spoke to me. Here was the epicenter of New York City nightlife, From clubs like the Palladium, World, and Pyramid, to live venues like the Cat Club and CBGB. One night after poring through the show listings in the Village Voice, I dragged Steve down to one of the city's greatest live venues, the Ritz, now Webster Hall. I don't remember who was performing, and it didn't matter. I was determined to see a show in New York. By the time we got to the venue, we just missed the concert. The crowd was filing out as the video for Stevie Van Zandt's star-studded anti-apartheid song Sun City filled a screen on stage. Shit, that's it? This is my one evening at the Ritz? Maybe I'll still see someone famous. Shortly before arriving in New York, I had seen a video of a blue-eyed English soul group called Curiosity Killed the Cat that featured the highly telegenic band with coiffed hair performing in a New York City alley. I became obsessed with the fantasy of running into the pretty lead singer somewhere in the Village. I scanned the crowd from the balcony, hoping to spot him. Just as I was about to give up, Steve pointed toward the stage at a tall, gangly man with a mess of black hair covering his face and wearing a black motorcycle jacket, black jeans, and dirty sneakers. Sophia, isn't that Johnny Ramone? Holy shit. Standing alone, by the stage, was the guitar player for the Ramones. I'll be right back. I raced down the stairs and elbowed my way through the crowd that was moving in the opposite direction. I marched right up to him and stuck out my hand. Hi, I'm Sophia Chang. You're Johnny Ramone, right? He took me in for a second and peered down at me over his rose-tinted wire-framed glasses. No, I'm Joey. Fuck. A massive, fumbling entree into the inner sanctum of the New York City punk scene. Well, you all look the same, I offered, playing off the fact that all the Ramones rock matching bowl cuts and biker-esque uniforms and shared a last name. Joey's lips spread slowly into a crooked smile, and he didn't say anything. I'm in. I kept babbling and didn't inhale for 3 straight minutes. My verve and sense of humor must have worn him down and worked up an appetite because he invited me out for burgers. I asked Steve to come along. Joey and I walked slightly ahead of him, gabba gabba hang. At one point, he slowed down to talk to Steve and said, I'm not causing a situation here, am I? Steve told him no. I was actually really gracious of him. We went to a small, dark spot near his apartment at 9th Street and 3rd Avenue. We stood at the jukebox and played music for each other. He was smart and funny and so very New York. It was a magical night. I had been hoping to find the singer of an utterly forgettable one-hit wonder band. Sorry, you guys. And here I was with the man who fronted the band that had defined the punk rock I grew up on back home. In retrospect, that single act of fearlessness had set into motion the events that would shape my entire career. It was my first big networking move, and I've been honing those skills ever since. I spent the next several months drudging through classes, dreaming of breaking out of Vancouver. New York was so amazing, but Paris was the obvious choice for me as a French major. In the summer of 1986, I went to Europe for the first time on a tour of England, France, and Italy with one of my closest friends, Jen Fraser. We shopped, visited landmarks and museums, ate great food, and it was the only time in my life I ever drank coffee. The soundtrack for the many hours we spent using our unlimited student Eurail passes was The Fine Young Cannibals, Echo and the Bunnymen, and Talking Heads, which we listened to by splitting a set of headphones to my Walkman. Google it, kids. But seeing the Ramones in Northern England was definitely the highlight of the trip. Their show was exactly as you'd expect, a nonstop jackhammer of three-chord rock and roll. And after the show, we all hung out at the hotel. Joey slouched forward at one point and tugged gently at my big white plastic hoop earring, just as ugly as it sounds. To his surprise, it slid right off my lobe. He pulled back suddenly and said, "Did that hurt?" It didn't, because it was a clip-on. Paris was exactly as I'd hoped. Les musées, les parcs, les cathédrales, le pain, le fromage, les pâtisseries. but everywhere I went, there were the Parisians. I thought I would move there after school, but I didn't feel like I could fit in. I would speak French with a near-perfect accent in the stores, and they would respond in their shit-ass English. And the women were so impressive in their makeup